This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. When the United States withdrew from Afghanistan a year and a half ago, there was a good deal of wishful thinking going on in Washington that the Taliban would be more pragmatic, less extreme than their previous rule from 1996 to 2001, and that the Taliban would honor its vaguely worded commitment to protect, quote, women's rights within Islamic law. But today, in Afghanistan, women do not have the right to work, study, or prosper. In fact, the Taliban seemed to find women so terrifying, soon after they seized power in August of 2021, they required all female mannequins removed from Kabul shop windows, or the forms had to have their heads removed. Instead, some shopkeepers found a way around the edict and covered the mannequins' faces with cloth sacks or black plastic bags. So that's for mannequins. Today, we're going to hear from Afghan women directly about how much their lives have changed. And we'll begin first in Afghanistan's capital of Kabul. We'll be speaking with a young woman we're going to call Mina. We are not using her real name to protect her from Taliban reprisal. Mina is a language teacher, and on the day of her final university exams, the Taliban were seizing control of the country, and fighters stormed her university and ordered the women to leave or else they'd be beaten. Mina, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Miss Meghna.
Hello.
This is Mina, living in Afghanistan.
Thank you so much for joining us. I just want listeners to know that this is a live conversation, and we're relying on internet connectivity between our On Point studio and Mina in Kabul. So there might be a slight delay in our conversation, but we're going to do the best we can. Mina, how often these days are you able to go outside?
Actually, we are not able. I'm talking about myself that I'm not able to go outside because the critical situation that I have, that I'm suffering, that as a teacher, that I was working in a international school, and now I'm hiding at my home, in my home, and I cannot go outside. So I will say that the other women as well, they can't go outside. When they are going outside, they are covering their faces. The situation, the woman's situation under the control of Taliban is severely bad, prohibitively as from education, living freely, working, and other social activities. We can't neither educate ourselves nor can live the way we want. We just think that we are in a bad situation. So this is our situation that we are living in our own country.
Mina, can you tell me the story of what happened to you on that day that you were sitting for your final university exams and the Taliban stormed the university?
We were on the exam that the papers they gave us, our teachers gave us our papers, that suddenly that the doors were closed, the windows, they just took the curtains, that they say that wear your mask, be sit properly. It was a very scary situation that we suffered, we faced on that time. I was asking that everyone, every girls were asking, my sisters as well, they were asking that what happened, is anything wrong here. They said that yes, Taliban entered our university and they said that you have to stop the exam, don't take exam from the girls and get out of the university right now. They were having the guns with themselves, and they were wearing such clothes that it was unacceptable. Their hair, their faces, their eyes. It was so scary. So it was so scary, and it was a very bad moment of my life. When I get out of the university, the every girls were just crying and yelling that what we did, what is our fault? Because we are a woman, this is our fault. that we are not a human. Taliban, they are thinking that women are like an animal. They don't have the right of education, the right of freedom, the right of working, and nothing else.
Now, you've had you and family members around you have had many such experiences of really encountering firsthand how the Taliban seem to view women. Can you tell us the story of what happened to your fiance, I believe, you at a Taliban checkpoint? He wanted to help a young woman that they had pulled from a car. What happened?
My fiance was in the car, and a girl was sitting in front of the car, and there was a checkpoint. Before the checkpoint, the car was near to that checkpoint. The girl said, "Oh, look at there is a foreword that they are shepishi, that they are so dirty, their ears are so dirty, they are not washing their body, their hair." So they said they have very bad smell. You know what? We can say Talib was in the car and he heard, and it was he was not having the gun with himself. No one didn't get that he is a Talib. So when they reached to that checkpoint, you know, the man, the Talib, that who was sitting in the car, he just came out of the car and took the girl's hand and take it out. The girl was crying that what I did, and the Talib was showing his head that please find something from our head, what is in it, smell us, and he was taking the girl's head that smell us, do I give a bad smell? And the girl was crying and no man helped her, and they took that girl. We don't know where, my fiance didn't know where they took that girl. What is the situation of that girl? No one knows. And they avoid the TV, the medias to record, to have something in televisions. And the girl who is the person who is saying that, who is making her voice, they are just killing her, or they are just taking her. This is the situation of women in Afghanistan.
Now, Mina, if I understand correctly, did you have to flee your home sometime after Afghanistan returned to Taliban rule?
I didn't get, sorry.
Sorry. Did you have to escape your home, or are you in hiding now? I mean, what is the situation of your life right now?
We just changed many times our house, our location. You know, when I was working in that international school before Taliban, I am belonging to a province that is completely Taliban on that time as well. They treated me by sending me messages in my number. In my private messages, and they were sending me warning letters. So I didn't mention that one. They were telling me that we will kill you one day when we take all the Afghanistan. We will see you. Then you know, when the Taliban came, we were so afraid, and they warned my father many times by sending the warning letters to the hand of our relatives. And because of that, we changed our places. You know, when I'm also today and now I'm also working, I am the person that I'm educated, and I want to help my people, my children, my other women, my sisters, that they are with me, they are living with me. And I am the one person that breadwinner of our family. No one is working, so I have to work. So I am working from home, online job I have. I am working with Americans, and they are sending me my salary by bank. When I go to the bank, and they ask me many times that why a foreigner is transferring money to me, they ask me the banks, and now now we are escaped. When I go to the bank, I cover my face. I wear a hijab that no one can know me, even my relatives. I am just hiding at my home.
So, Mina, we're going to talk more about your current situation in a few minutes. But I want to ask you this. You're perhaps in your early 30s, your age, which means that for the vast majority of your life, you were living in an Afghanistan that was not under Taliban rule. How different is your life today than it was before the coalition withdrawal in 2000, a year and a half ago?
You know, on that time, I could study. I could work.
Mina? Okay, we're going to try to get Mina back because there's much more of her story that we all need to hear. We're going to head towards a break now. We are talking with Afghan women about what their lives are like today, a year and a half after the United States completed its withdrawal from Afghanistan. And I want to note, Mina is not her real name. Women in Afghanistan speaking out take considerable risk with their lives and safety in order to share their stories. And we'll hear more about how Mina's living in these days in a few minutes. And when we come back, we'll also hear from the former Minister of Education for Afghanistan and the director of a major women's NGO as well. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're trying to get a deeper understanding of what life is like for women in Afghanistan, 18 months after the completion of the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan. I'm joined now by Nadia Nassim. She's executive director of the NGO Women for Afghan Women, and she joins us from Ottawa in Canada. Nadia, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna, and hello, and a warm greetings to the guest and also to your audience. Thank you very much for inviting me for this show and this important discussion.
Also with us from Phoenix, Arizona, is Rangina Hamidi. She's the first and so far last female Minister of Education for Afghanistan, a position she lost in August on August 15th, the day Kabul fell. She soon had to flee the capital, though has been back to Afghanistan subsequently. Today, she's a professor at the Thunderbird School of Global Management at Arizona State University. Rangina Hamidi, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be on the show.
Well, and we also we have Mina back as well from Kabul, so we will hear more from her in just a moment. But Rangina, let me start with you, if I may. Can you tell us the stories that you're hearing from family and friends still in Afghanistan? How accurate, based on what you know, is the reporting that we're seeing here in the United States?
Thank you. Well, that's actually a very difficult question because Afghanistan is a complex country in a complex situation as we speak. As you mentioned, I held one of the highest positions that women could hold in the previous administration. And there was a lot of fear about me returning back to a country that is painted and viewed by world reporting as the most dangerous place on earth for women to be. And of course, I had to go with that fear in mind. But I have to be fair and honest to say that from the minute I landed back in Kabul and I traveled to Kandahar, which is my hometown, and back to the US, the whole trip lasted about 20 days. I have to say that, yes, things have changed. Things have drastically changed from what I had been living for 20 years, from 2003 until 2021, when I was forced to flee. However, as a woman, I did not feel threatened. I did not feel, driving in the cars, that there was actually anybody following me or stopping me or warning me to do things a certain way. Of course, I've also learned through age and experience that you have to learn to be wise and make decisions and choices appropriate to the space and to the environment that we're in. And so, of course, I had to make those choices and decisions, being a woman, of course, dressing differently, covering way more than I did prior to the fall last year. But I did see, I'm not denying my sister's reporting on how she's living, because of course, every single story and every single situation is different. And that's what makes Afghanistan a complex society in a complex country. But I was also surprised to see women on the streets shopping, both in Kabul and in Kandahar, women working in offices that are not NGOs, of course, because the day I arrived in Kandahar was the day the announcement was made that women will no longer be able to work in NGOs. But private sector entities such as small businesses or medium-sized businesses, the women that I'm working and supporting in Kandahar, they continue to come and work, but they are dressed according to the norms and the traditions that the Taliban are putting in place, or the traditions that existed prior to the fall of Kabul. Now, we have to also remember, I want the audience to remember, that Kabul is in the capital of Afghanistan. So the social context of Kabul has always been very different than the rural provincial lifestyle. And of course, that makes it different, because the changes that women in Kabul have seen are far more drastic than the changes that women in the provinces have seen.
Okay, so let me turn to Nadia on this, because I wonder if, acknowledging the complexity of Afghan society, I definitely want to do that. And part of that complexity is that, as in virtually any human society, it sounds like the people with perhaps more cosmopolitan connections, more money, more social connections, perhaps have a different experience when what rights are withdrawn than people who are poorer or live in more rural places. I mean, I'm just quite asking that about Afghanistan and Afghanistan's women now. Nadia, what do you think?
What I'm thinking when it comes like the social norms, what it goes like, there are like differences in terms of the social norms in the big cities of Afghanistan and also in the provinces or remit areas. But when it comes to the rights of women to get education, no matter where the woman lives, in Afghanistan, people are in favor of education. Whether somebody is living in Kabul, which is the capital, if somebody is in the remote area in the other provinces of Afghanistan. So this right of education is something that the woman, no matter where, that should be given to them. Yes. And same with the work. So no matter, like, it's not only like in private sectors, like when see, okay, private sectors, if they are allowed to work in certain areas or if they have to go with medical services the providers of medical services, the women are allowed to go. But when it comes to women who are working in NGO, they don't have to work because they don't respect or they don't apply like the social norms in terms of how they have to wear the hijabs there, or same with education. So this is something like, to me, it is like clearly a gender discrimination against women in Afghanistan. So and this discrimination is unfortunately all over in Afghanistan, no matter it's Kabul, it's other major cities or the other provinces. Because everybody, every woman is affected from the orders of the Taliban in Afghanistan in terms of work, education, and numerous other orders to exclude women from the society.
Okay. Mina, I think we have you back in Kabul. Are you there?
Yeah, glad to be back.
Yes, thank you. Can you tell us what do you think about what you just heard from Ranjina Hamidi, in particular, that the reality is more complex than perhaps what is being reported internationally when it comes to the day-to-day life for Afghan women?
Giving information regarding those who are working with NGOs, maybe there are some people that they are working, but not all of the women they are working, because they announced that the women should stay home. Just the doctors, the nurses, they are going to their duties. But still, I have heard that they stopped their work, daily work as well. They ordered that they have to come 2 days a week. So I am in Kabul, and this is the situation that I am hearing and I am facing.
Mm. Now, Mina, I want to just make it clear to you.
We are talking about generally all the women, not about some women.
Yes. If I can, though, what I'd like to do for a moment, though, is just focus on you for another minute, because I want to share something with listeners. That in the process of preparing for today's conversation, our producer, Steph, who had been talking with you and found you, you first said you wanted to actually use your real first name. And you wanted to give more specific details about who you are and what your life is now. And to be totally transparent to listeners, I want them to know that it's us here at On Point who decided not to do that, because we are concerned about your safety. You said you're in hiding right now. But Mina, what I want to know is, why did you want to take that risk to be so public about who you are when you do fear Taliban punishment?
Yes. At first, I didn't know that it is live. So after that, when sir told me that it is live, that everyone can hear, so I accepted that I will change my name.
Mm. Okay. But also, I believe that you saw this and still see this perhaps as an opportunity to help you with another goal, because you want to leave Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I told sir that I want to use my name, that I want to use this conversation as a proof that I want to leave Afghanistan. I want to use this opportunity because I'm suffering a very bad situation. I'm thinking about my family, about my sisters, about my own self. I want to grow. I want to get education, and I want to live in a peace area, and I want to grow up my child in a safety place. That's why I was telling that.
Mm-hmm. Well, so Ranjina Hamidi, I wanted listeners to know that, because Mina is trying to leave Afghanistan as a refugee. That's how bad her situation is. Now, while, again, I acknowledge the complexity of any society, including Afghan society, we do have such a massive change for day-to-day life for many women that, you know, people like Mina, who should represent the future of the country, still want to leave. Is that not also an adequate measure of the state of what it's like for women there today?
Thank you, Magna. And I agree with you, and I agree with Mina, and I agree. First of all, I want to make a clarification. What I'm talking about is not suggesting that people, individuals, families don't have right to leave and protect themselves and their families. My father and my mother made that decision when I was about 4 years old in the early 1981, to leave us, to make us refugees as little children. And as an adult, I returned back to my birth country of Afghanistan. So I know the reality of why people are forced to make certain decisions in life. And I understand and agree on all fronts that life for women in particular, but also men, have become unbearable in Afghanistan. This is a fact. What I'm trying to come across is that Afghanistan's population is 40 million people, men and women. The reality is that no country on the face of this earth is willing to accept 40 million population to become refugees in their countries. And so while I understand and accept the real stories of the problems that exist on a day-to-day basis facing every single individual, particularly women and girls, I, after all, was responsible for educating the future generation, particularly my girls, my daughters across the country. So you can imagine the burden that I carry on my shoulders having left the country and having left the situation in the hands that it is in today. But at the same time, we must also engage to find solutions to this problem, because merely taking people away, the brain drain that Afghanistan is suffering from already, and continuing that brain drain path is not the solution for the long term of this country's sustainability or sustenance for the people that will continue to remain.
So, Nadia Nassim, okay, this is the point of this conversation and this issue, which has truly confounded me. Because yes, it seems like there's consensus here. There has to be some kind of solution to this problem, the problem being the plight of women in Afghanistan. But not everybody in Afghanistan sees it as a problem. I mean, right? The Taliban are in power. They are the ones making the decision. How can any solution be forcoming for as long as Taliban leadership, as far as I understand, continues to hold and act upon these retrograde attitudes about women?
So, I mean, looking in the past, after August 15 of 2021, there is one order after another. So there is, when it came to girls cannot get education, like they can't go to school after class six, it's a temporary, but it was never temporary. So, I mean, looking at that, when we are looking at the solution, but before thinking about the solution, about one problem that you just face with another order. So how come, like, looking at education, then you come back, okay, so woman even can't go to university. Then you're looking thinking about the impact of that order on women, then all of a sudden come, then women can't work and endure. So it's a kind of like one order after another order that the impacts women in all over Afghanistan. So now we just, it is not one solution. It's not a solution. We all know actually what the solution is, like the rights of women should be given to them. They should be equally treated in a society. They should be given those equal opportunities. So that's the solution. They should be, they should have the right to get education. They should have the right to work. Why not? They are half part of the society. And it's not only like, when I say that all of the women are impacted, and even the children, I can say impacted. I can give one of the examples, actually, the operations that we have in Afghanistan, like taking care of the children of incarcerated mothers. So our Women for Afghan Women organization is the only organization that provided services before August 15 for these children and after that. So now the rule is that children, female children, girls who are over 12 years old, they can't be like in a shelter or protected with the other children after 12 years old. So they have to live with the relatives, not in this children's support center. So how now see the impact apart from what we just discussed? Women who end up being in the prison in Afghanistan, even other relatives, they are not willing to take care of their children of the woman who ended up in the prison. Most of those families are very poor. They can't even take care of their own children. And when it comes to taking children of a woman who ended up in the prison, they don't do it. So now what comes if that woman has a daughter who is over 12 years old, 13 or 14? She ended up like being abused, living in one place, in a few nights in one relative house, and other. So see, like now this girl ended up like either a forced marriage, underage marriage. So this is like this impact, or these stories are, it's quite heartbreaking.
Yeah, heartbreaking indeed. We have more to talk about when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about life for women in Afghanistan. Today, I'm joined by Rangina Hamidi. She is a former Minister of Education for Afghanistan, a position she lost after the fall of Afghanistan to the Taliban. She has subsequently returned several times to Afghanistan. Today, she is a professor at the Thunderbird School of Global Management at Arizona State University. Nadia Nassim is also with us. She's executive director of the NGO Women for Afghan Women. And we also have today from Kabul, Mina, who is a language teacher in Kabul, and we are not using her real name for fear of her safety and possible reprisal from the Taliban. Now, Mina, I want to read to you a comment that we're getting from one of our listeners here on this program who says, "The United States knew this would happen in Afghanistan, but popular opinion in this country wanted us to withdraw. There was no winning either way. The United States could have stayed in Afghanistan forever, but there would always be problems." Mina, what do you think about that?
At first, I want to answer Ms. Hamidi that she mentioned that no country is able to accept 40 million refugees. I agree, but the exact problem is those who were and are working with the government and other private sectors. At least do those who get the opportunity may and will live for the good of her or her family. If this government gave us the woman's right to educate ourselves, to work freely, but no, the current government do not give us the rights. That is why people are trying to leave. People left, and people living abroad cannot define the situation that we are suffering. So if America comes back, if our country is completely free, so I don't want to leave Afghanistan, I will stay here, I will be happy, I will be so happy to live in our country. No countries can be in place of our country. Our country is our mother. So we love our country. So if America come back to Afghanistan, we will be, not just me, all the women will be so happy, because they, I know there will be some situation, some problems, but for us, maybe the situation will change. Maybe we will work freely. We will we will educate ourselves. So I will be so happy.
Okay, so let me let Rangina respond to that, because to put a finer point on it, Ms. Hamidi, Mina is saying that perhaps your perspective is informed by the fact that you were able to leave Afghanistan and can return and then leave again when you want, which is an option she does not have.
I absolutely agree with her. And that is both a privilege that I have and a curse, because I have the ability to leave and I have left. So I do carry that guilt with me constantly on a daily basis. However, the issue is much more complex. I am in no shape or form referring or implying that Ms. Mina should not leave the country. When you have the opportunity to protect yourself and your future and your children and give them a better opportunity, you have absolutely every right as a citizen of this world to be able to do that. What I'm talking about is referring to the millions of people who don't and won't have that opportunity. So I'm in no shape or form implying that people should not leave. However, to think about the future of a country and the situation that Afghanistan is currently in with this administration, and you know, to the point, Magna, about the person who's the comment that was made, it is true. America was not going to be remaining in Afghanistan forever. America spent 20 years, billions of dollars, many lives lost. Let's not even count the loss that Afghanistan paid. So it was not sustainable for America to remain. And no country in the world historically has ever proven that a nation, one nation can come and remain in another nation to fix its problems and continue its progress through a fake economy, through a model of dependency that we had. Afghanistan eventually had to free itself from America and NATO's presence. And unfortunately, we as a nation and we as a people were not able to address our critical issues of security, of inclusivity. You know, it's funny that people talk about inclusivity today. However, I would challenge the previous government's, you know, the 20-year administration's policy on inclusivity too. America rejected the Taliban's plea in 2003 to leave them alone and not fight, because Secretary Rumsfeld at that time had rejected the notion of negotiating with terrorists or people who were fighting. Yet from 2017 until 2021, America led the longest peace process deal in Doha, which led to the fall of the Republic. So let's remember our recent history to know that America's commitment, and it's not viable for America to make a commitment to remain in a country and fix its social and gender issues and problems that Afghanistan has and will continue to have.
Yeah, so point well taken. At the same time, it seems to me, though, just to add a little bit more detail to what you're saying, Ms. Hamidi, when the final sets of negotiations, as you're saying, going on in Doha came around, look, the Trump administration decided, as you well know, to not include the Afghan government at the table. Exactly. We were negotiating with the Taliban. So a full, you know, the United States came full circle in terms of its views of whether or not to negotiate with the Taliban from, you know, 2003 to 2019 and 20. However, what I'm concerned about right now is that, in a sense, if we take the past and draw a line to the present, it feels as if the rights of women have always been something of a bargaining chip between Afghan leadership, whomever that might be, the Taliban, and the United States.
Absolutely.
But now what we have is only the Taliban. And what I wonder is, for a group who defines itself as a fundamentalist interpretation of Islam, can there be any hope for some kind of recovery of the rights and type of life that women had prior to 2020 or 2021 under the current regime?
Unfortunately, I don't think we can return to prior to August 15, 2021. The Afghanistan from 2001 until 2021 is long gone. This reality has changed. There's a group of people in charge of Afghanistan that the Afghanistan population did not want, particularly its women did not want, but they're in power right now. And so I think what I am trying to convey is that we need to be pragmatic about the situation as we're in. I do not see, and nobody in America, you know, disagrees with me on this, that America is not going to go into Afghanistan militarily again. What it is doing is to continue the engagement process with the Taliban in the hopes that things can turn around. Will it return back to the way it was? I highly doubt it. But I think, again, we need to be pragmatic and realistic about the situation and hope for things to get better with the fact in place that, yes, 55 out of the 82 decrees that have been given by the Taliban since they've taken over have revolved around women's issues. And that's pretty scary that a regime is predominantly occupied with how women live, dress, you know, come out. So, of course, that's a major concern for all of us. But the fact of the matter is they're in power right now. They have guns. They have authority. They can kill as they wish. They can kidnap as they wish. And we can sit and criticize all of that, which we are doing. But simply criticizing is not helping the situation on the ground. And I think as an international responsible community, we need to continue to engage on the ground, something that the Trump administration did not do by not including the Afghan government or the Afghan people in the negotiation process. I think it is time for Afghans across the globe to re-engage with this administration to figure out a solution, because the last thing that I heard from men and women on the ground was nobody is wanting to go to a civil war again. People are tired of killing. People are tired of destruction. And they've suffered this for 40 plus years in their lives right now.
Nadia, Nassim, let me ask you, I mean, respectfully, engaging on the ground, while it sounds like a clear directive, also seems very vague to me. You're executive director of Women for Afghan Women, which ostensibly was a NGO on the ground there. What would more international engagement in Afghanistan to you reasonably look like?
Looking at the situation, as I just mentioned before, one order after another order, that a majority of all those orders impacted women. And when we look at the international community, we only see the statements are there, and there is no change in the outcome of any orders which have been so far on women in terms of education, work, and also there are a list of orders that impacted women. So I mean it is only whether they are NGOs or other individual Afghan in Afghanistan that they are suffering from the situation. I mean, particularly women, I would say, because they are affected more. It's always what they say, there should be more pressure on the authorities so that a reversal is on all these orders that women are impacted. However, when as I mentioned before, when you look at one order, but after that, all of a sudden come the other. It's a kind of disappointing to see what's happening in Afghanistan right now. And I hope there is apart from those statements that's come out from the international community, there should be concrete actions in terms of reversing this order, because this is something that the people of Afghanistan, it's when the rights are violated. So, of course, nobody can tolerate when their rights are violated, which right now.
So let me turn back to Mina, who's in Kabul. You know, Mina, another thing that the international community could do is perhaps use the tool of economic sanctions or more economic sanctions against the Taliban regime to, as Nadia was saying, put pressure on the regime. However, you know, Afghanistan right now is deep in winter, and there are Afghans starving at the moment, literally starving. So what effect, who would suffer the most? Who would be impacted the most if the United States or the international community strengthens its sanctions against Afghanistan?
the people who are suffering this, that the children, they are suffering, the women, the men, everyone is suffering the situation. You know, some women, they, because of their to make their homes warm, they start selling their kids, they start selling their parts of bodies. So it is a very bad situation that we are suffering, that everyone is suffering, the poor people, that they don't have anyone to earn money to work for them, and they are suffering this situation.
Tell me more. I mean, what do you think, Mina? What do you think your future is going to be like?
So we just hope for the best, for that the freedom of my homeland. I just wish that my country should be free, and they give the women's right. They should have, if this government gave us women right to educate ourselves, to work freely, that the situation will be good, that they let everyone to stay in their homeland, so we don't have any problem. So if they are doing the situation the same, if they are continuing this, if they are not giving us the right, so it will be difficult for our country, for the people, for everyone to suffer.
Rangina Hamidi, there's another option. What if, again, this is pure speculation, but I wonder what the impact would be, say, if the international community actually relaxed its sanctions, allowed food aid into the country. Would that actually make a difference at all?
I mean, of course, it is making a difference. As you said, those people who are extremely in vulnerable situations, they are benefiting from this aid because this is the only source of, the only source of income or the only source of goods that are coming to them. But I would also say that depending on humanitarian assistance is not a long-term solution for Afghanistan either. The people of Afghanistan need jobs. The people of Afghanistan need sustenance to be able to, you know, provide for themselves and their families and their children through initiatives that they take, you know, on their own, which can bring them a dignified living. And that would require for our political leaders to engage with the Taliban at a much serious level. You can't, you know, yes, in the past year and a half, the world has been treating or dealing with Afghanistan on an emergency basis by providing emergency humanitarian assistance. But I really wonder how much longer that can continue without addressing the critical issue of what do we do with Afghanistan now that it's in the hands of the Taliban?
Well, Rangina Hamidi, she was the former Minister of Education for Afghanistan. Today, she's a professor at the Thunderbird School of Global Management at Arizona State. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
And Najina Nassim, Executive Director of Women for Afghan Women. Najina, thank you so much as well.
Thank you.
And Mina, with us from Kabul. Mina, I am so grateful that you shared your story and your thoughts with us today. Thank you, and please do stay safe.
Thank you, ma'am, and it's my pleasure, and I am really appreciated to give me a chance.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.